Today's Teisho will be on case 35 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan. Seijo's soul is separated. Goso said to his monks, Seijo's soul separated from her being, which was the real Seijo. Mumon's comment, when you realize what the real is, you will see that we pass from one husk to another like travelers stopping for a night's lodging. But if you did not realize it yet, I earnestly advise you not to rush about wildly. When earth, water, fire, and air suddenly separate, you will be like a crab struggling in boiling water with its 7 or 8 arms and legs. When that happens, don't say, I didn't warn you. Mumon's verse, the moon above the clouds is the same as ever. Valleys and mountains separate from each other. All are blessed, all are blessed. Are they one or are they two? Thank you so much for coming this morning to practice Zen. It's a really beautiful day, and I hope you had a good sit. People sometimes misunderstand what Zen is all about, you know. When you first start practicing Zen, one of the things that you notice is that you are going to be more relaxed. So, you know, if you come into, say, an evening sit, and you're tense from the day, and you sit down on the cushion, and you watch your breath, even if you are quite tense, if you keep bringing your mind back to the breath, and you don't allow yourself to chase after your obsessive thoughts, it can be a struggle. Your thoughts pull you away and you sort of want to go with them, but then you keep coming back to the moment, back to the breath. And it may be a struggle, but at some point during the sit or when you get up, you're going to notice you're much calmer and more composed. Your worries may not all be gone, but you may feel a lot calmer. And eventually, you'll notice this in your daily life. You'll notice that things don't always quite upset you so much. And you have the tools to deal with challenges in a different way. So instead of getting very upset and angry or fearful and anxious, you know that you can watch your breath, you can sit down on the cushion, and you've seen it work before. You've seen your anxiety go away. And knowing that it's done this in the past gives you the confidence to do it again. And as I say, if you work at it, you really will be calmer. It's quite wonderful. People have studied the effects of meditation on human health. And it's well known that when people do Zazen, there's a relaxation response. And that this is quite good for you. It's good for your blood pressure. It helps to avoid accumulating plaque in the walls of your arteries and things like that. This is one of the many benefits of meditation. However, meditation is not just about being relaxed. Even though it's important to be relaxed, that's not really all we're doing, or even primarily what we're doing when we practice Zen. If this were just a practice of, say, tranquilization, it would have great value to people, and it would really be wonderful if everybody did it. But it would leave certain kinds of problems unaddressed. You know, I just read in the newspaper that the number of Americans taking antidepressants has doubled. That's amazing, right? It was a headline in some of the papers, and it was on some of the news aggregators like Huffington Post. And it's no surprise, right? I mean, the society is under a lot of stress. People have lost their jobs, or they're afraid of losing their jobs. Their savings are greatly depleted from the stock market collapse. And, you know, all kinds of indicators of confidence are down. So people have lots of reasons for taking antidepressants. That's a very American, I think, very American solution to the problem, right? I mean by that it's very practical. If you're stressed, have an antidepressant, and you won't be stressed. And you can get what you need to do done. That leaves unanswered the question, why am I so stressed? It doesn't really change necessarily our understanding of things, you know, and the way we live. So if Zen is just about getting calmer when you're frightened or anxious, then it's very valuable. And it's free, you know, unlike antidepressant drugs. And it has other positive benefits which they may not have, even though there's nothing wrong with them. But the point is that just taking the pills or just doing Zazen for like a release of tension doesn't solve sort of like that deeper problem. Why am I needing this medicine? You know. And so part of Zen is learning how to be calm, because if our minds are extremely distracted and fearful, or if they're in obsessive compulsive loops, if we're caught in obsessive compulsive thinking, or if we're so fearful that we're sort of panicky, or if we're, you know, very depressed, you know, it's very difficult under those circumstances to really analyze or understand our situation. So if you think of meditation as a kind of therapy, step one is just letting people become more calm and stable mentally. And that's an enormous, if Zen did nothing else, I think it would be well worth doing. You know, that's such a great benefit, just being released from like the hell of anxiety, you know, or the hell of unhappiness. And it takes a lot of practice just to get out of that hell sometime. But the more you sit, the easier it is to work through your problems and reach a place where you're calm and stable. And that's really wonderful. But as I say, you know, there's more to Zen practice than that. You know, that's like step one, and then step two is to, you know, we're really investigating reality. Really investigating reality. As we investigate reality, you know, a lot of things we believe about it may turn out to be false. As you know, when people come in here to the Zendo for the first time, I always explain that Zen is not a path of devotion. I always say there's nothing wrong with devotion. But Zen really isn't like a path of devotion. It's a path of prajna, like a wisdom. And wisdom doesn't quite work. Because people don't understand that wisdom is like knowledge, right? You know, you have to really work hard to get wisdom, and wisdom is like knowledge. You know, you could translate prajna as knowledge. Zen is about investigating reality from the standpoint of the non-dual mind. So first of all, we have to get calm. And once we're calm, generally speaking, we feel less separate from things. If we're not frightened or angry or nervous, it becomes easier to feel connected to the things around us. And when we feel connected to the things around us, we're in a different state of mind. It's not our ordinary state of mind. That connectedness is a different way of knowing. And when we're in that connected or non-dual mind, we can begin to observe the world in a different way. It's not easy because we have all these mental habits, you know. So for a long time, our habits can get in the way. And we also have fear, continue to have some fear and anxiety. But little by little, if you practice meditation a long time, it becomes possible to enter a non-dual mind and then gradually investigate different aspects of reality. And that's really the heart of Zen practice. You know, our anxiety, our fear, and our unhappiness are caused by the way we understand the world. That's one of the first teachings of the Buddha. One of the first things the Buddha said is, you know, you are as you think. You know, how you think is quite fundamental to your condition. And so unhappiness, fear, anger, and so on, generally speaking, are caused by our mental state, how we make sense of events. Now, it's true that, you know, you can get in a car and have a car accident, and it's not your fault, and you could suffer greatly. There's no question that you'd be in a lot of pain. But even with something like that, you know, how you deal with it is quite flexible. You know, you could be bitter and angry, you could be overwhelmed, or you could respond in a different way. You know, you could take responsibility for your own situation. I don't mean blaming yourself for the accident. I mean you'd say, look, I've got to get out of this. I have to be proactive. And so having that kind of a mindset would make a big difference in how you dealt with the calamity. So Zen is about transforming our understanding of things in an honest way. You know, there are meditation practices where people, visualize things. You know, so if you're stressed, you could sit on a cushion and you could tell yourself, "I'm floating on the water. You know, it's peaceful and calm. You know, there's the sun overhead. It's so beautiful. Life is so good." You know? And again, that's something that you're free to try, but it's not Zen. Zen wants to know, you know, why am I stressed? Or it wants to know, is life good? You know. So Zen has like a different attitude. It's sort of like an investigating mind. Not really just about being calm, about investigating. This koan is about a woman named Seijo. And it says, Seijo and her soul are divided in two. The koan doesn't make much sense, I think, without a little of the backstory. This is based upon a Chinese ghost story, or a Chinese, story of mystery. You know. When I was growing up, there used to be a story about a guy who dated a girl. He was driving down the road, and a very attractive woman was on the side of the road, and he picked her up, and they went out on a date. Maybe they went to the prom. I think that was it. He didn't have a date for the prom, and this woman came, and they had an enchanting evening, right? And she told him her name, and then at the end of the evening she vanished, and all she left was her sweater. Right? And then the next day he discovered that she had died years before, just before the prom. Right? She got to go to the prom with him, and then he thought, did it really happen? But there was the sweater, see? So it's like a spooky story. So this is like a spooky story. Seijo is growing up in this town in China, and she is in love since she's like a little baby with her cousin Ochu. And Seijo and Ochu are just like little kids, like 3-4 years old, and they're walking down the street holding hands. And everybody in town sees these kids and goes, oh, there goes the old man and the old woman. Right? It's like they're octogenarians who have been married for 50 years. And they grow up, Seijo and Ochu grow up thinking they're going to be husband and wife and live together. When Seijo is a teenager, almost 19 or 20, her family decides that she should marry someone else, not her cousins, Ochu. And so she is betrothed to another. But she's devastated, you know, because she loves Ochu, and she can't imagine living without him. Now, in China, you know, at that time, and even now, in parts of the Chinese world, you're supposed to do what your parents say. That's like number one rule. So, Seijo was supposed to put her own happiness aside and marry this man her family had picked. And it was absolutely undebatable. Right? Not debatable. So she decided that she would try to adjust, but she couldn't. And she cried and cried and couldn't get over the situation. And finally, she and Ochu decided to elope. And so they elope and they go away to another land. They get in the Yangtze and they go north. And they find a place where they're free. And they live together in happiness. And then, for a number of years, they have 3 kids. They're happy. But all this time, Seijo is not really happy. Not entirely happy, I should say, because she misses her family. She misses her mother and her father. She misses her village. So she managed to get away. She managed to escape, but she's not entirely happy. Something's missing. So anyway, after many discussions, she and Ochu decide to go back to her village and try to patch things up with her family, even though what she's done is quite bad. From a Confucian standpoint. And even in America, you would be in trouble with your parents. You know. So they go back, and they get to the town, which is near the water, and in their boat, their little boat on the river. And Seijo is really eager to see her parents, but she doesn't know how she'll be received, so she sends Ochu. And Ochu knocks on the door, and the parents come to the door, and they don't remember him. And he says, you know, my name is Ochu. I'm the guy who eloped with your daughter, Seijo. And we've come back to make amends. The parents are bewildered, you know. They say, what are you talking about? Seijo's right upstairs. We remember you now. You know, you're the guy she wanted to elope with. Well, we wouldn't permit it. So she's upstairs in her room where she's been for, 5 years. She's listless and lifeless. She's barely alive. Ever since you went away, she hasn't been able to be happy even for a moment. So anyway, Ochu is surprised by this, since he's been living with Seijo in a faraway land, and he can't believe it. So he runs back to get Seijo at the boat, and they both come up to the house. And so they come up to the house, and then the parents see Seijo, and Ochu. And they all go upstairs together, and as soon as the two Seijos see each other, they turn into one. So that's the story. Isn't that a lovely story? Now, you know, the thing is, in life, things aren't so easy. Perhaps you've noticed, you know. In other words, magical solutions are hard to find. This is about, there's so many dimensions to this koan, you know. So you could say that, you know, Seijo was unhappy, and so she went away. Now this is, normally when we're unhappy, that's what we want to do, right? We want to go away. And we think when we're unhappy that if we go away, it will make things better. We all think this way, right? I do too, you know. And everybody else does. I was talking to somebody the other day who's been having a very hard time at Rutgers because of the financial situation. And his department is quite a bit overspent. They owe like $300,000. They're so overspent. And this person I was talking to said, I can't wait till I can retire. Right? And he was just talking about it obsessively. Apparently he and his wife have, they're looking at retirement spots. And so you can see why he's thinking this way, right? I mean, so many things are challenging in his life that he wants to go away. So he's dreaming of like a sweet retirement in, the British Virgin Islands or someplace like that. You know. And it makes him feel better right now. Of course, I know people who are retired, and it's not what you might think, you know. For one thing, retired people don't always feel, all the time you're working, in your working life, people dream of not having to work. Maybe you've noticed this, you know. You go into your job, and the minute you get there, when I get into my office sometimes, there's stickies all over my computer. This is because, my assistant knows that I won't look at it if she leaves it on the table. She knows I'll look at my computer, so she puts these stickies. And it's like, call, email, you have to do this. And, you come in the morning and it's like, you have to hit the ground running, you know. And all day long you're running, and at the end of the day you're still running. And you might think, oh, retirement, that's going to be so sweet. You know? I'll just get up at 11 o'clock. It'll be like every day will be Saturday, right? You know, every day we'll be able to just sleep in. Have a cup of coffee. But actually, it's not like that. You know, people who are retired can be quite unhappy. You know, they miss having the stickies on their computer. It sounds incredible, but they do. You know, they go up and look at their computer, but there's no stickies, you know. And they look at the news, and there's nothing very interesting on the news, and then they sigh, you know. Sometimes people have other things they can do. You know, maybe they work in a community activity, or they play golf or something like that. But a lot of retirees miss their jobs. You know, and also there's this other issue. You know, a lot of my friends who are retired academics. You know. And they all retired when the stock market was flying high, you know. And so now their savings are quite reduced, you know. So all of a sudden, these people they had big plans, and now they're counting their pennies, you know. And that's a shock, right? But that goes with the territory, you know. That's part of being retired. So. you know, when we're in a difficult situation, we always imagine that if we could just go away, it would be better. And this is like a basic idea of ours, right? That you know, when we're in a bind, let me get out, let me go, and I'll be happy somewhere else. You know? But as I say, it doesn't always work out that way. And in fact, you know, for Seicho too, you know, she's unhappy. Her parents are forcing her to do something that she really shouldn't do. I'm not a big fan of filial piety. I don't believe that you should always do what your parents say, having never done what my parents said myself. But, you know, so leaving home was a good idea. But when she gets there, you know, not 100% happy. She has the partner, life partner of her dreams. She wanted children, so she has children. But, you know, something's missing. Something's still missing, right? So she goes home, right? And, of course, going home is, you know, not, you know, so exile or escape wasn't what she planned. It didn't work out the way she planned. And then she goes home, and that doesn't work out the way she planned either. Right? Because when she goes home, her parents just don't go, all is forgiven, right? There's another Seijo to deal with, see? You know, and that's because maybe, you know, the parents still are imagining a different kind of daughter, right? So it's not the way she expected it to be there either. And so the koan's kind of saying, when will we ever be able to have a unified mind in accord with the way? When we go here, we're divided. When we go there, we're divided. When we go there, we're divided. And when we come back, we're divided. See? So this is like a fundamental human problem. And I'm sure you've felt it. You know, I'm sure you've felt it. When I was in graduate school, one of my good friends was a guy named Larry Stone, and he was a wonderful person. His parents were wonderful. I worked for his parents. They were in the import business. I had a couple summer jobs with them, and they were really very nice. Larry Stone's mom once showed me the numbers tattooed to her arm by the Nazis. She was scheduled to go to the gas chamber, and she survived. She and her husband, and she came to the United States and started an import business. And their son, Larry, was a good friend of mine. Anyway, Larry and I both were in graduate school. He was in Comp Lit because he knew all these languages. And I was not as intelligent as Larry. And so I was in English because I did know English, you know, even though I didn't know any other language very well. So anyway, we actually lived in the same apartment house on apartments. Mine was on the lower floor, and his was on the upper floor. And I had helped him get that apartment. And anyway, I am a very slow thinker and a slow writer. So I'm not one of these people who can sit down and bang out 20 pages. It takes me, it's eternally slow for me to write. So I have to write like a little bit every day, you know. So when I was writing my graduate papers, I wasn't one of these people who could read all the books, sit down, and just like over the weekend just produce 20 pages. That was like impossible for me. So what I would do is read the books a little by little and write. And little by little, like I'd have 2 pages, then I'd have 4 pages, then I'd have 6 pages. And this is not necessarily the best way to do things, but it's the only way I could do things, because I'm also a slow reader. You know. So anyway, I would be down there, and this was the days when people used to have typewriters. And when you type on a typewriter, you push the keys down, but there's no electronic component. So it's just manual force makes the key hit the key hits this little roller, which is made of rubber, hard rubber. And it, in between the rubber and the key, there's a piece of paper, and between the key and the paper, there's a ribbon with that's been soaked in ink. It's very primitive. So anyway, when you hit the keys, it goes clack, 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 clack. So when you type, you know, this has just disappeared from the earth, but when people type, you could just hear this clack, 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 and it would be quite loud. Pow, 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 pow. And we had the cheap apartments, you know, because we didn't have any money. We were just students. And my friend Larry could hear me. He'd be up there thinking, oh my God, I've got to write. I've got to write. And then he'd hear this clack, 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 clack. He'd think, oh God, he's writing again. And he'd actually come downstairs to say, what's going on, you know? And he'd go, are you writing again? And he'd look so worried, right? You know. And he thought I was really on the ball. He didn't realize that this is the only way I can get anything done. You know? But it would terrify him, right? And he used to go, he would get so terrified because he couldn't write that he would go down to the Pike Place Market and look at wines, and he began to read all these books on wine, and that was like his going away, like his escape, right? Well, anyway, one time he talked to me, and he said, you know, basically, you know, I really wish I weren't in graduate school. I'm so unhappy here, and I really love wine. You know, I'd like to go study wine. But my parents, who were about the best parents a person could ask for. Larry's parents were wonderful people. But they still had high hopes that he was going to be like a professor, you know. That would have been quite good for them, you know, good for their egos, you know. And Larry was very smart. He was really quite smart. You know, he spoke German, French. He'd had a lot of languages under his belt. He understood philosophy very well, but his heart wasn't in it, you know, and he was pulled in two directions. You know, so this happens to us all the time. You know, we want to be one place, and now it's not true that he should have stayed in graduate school. You know, that's not true. It's not true that if you change places, every place is equally bad, you know. He finally got up the nerve to do what his heart told him to do, you know. He actually decided to go to school and become and study wine, and he became a wine steward, a sommelier. He went to some big culinary institute, I guess maybe even in France. And he became a sommelier, like a one of the best. He actually won an international competition in France. He was like the first American ever to win. He was in a contradiction, and he didn't know how to get out. And you could say he dreamed of flying away, going away. I'm sure his life has contradictions now, you know. But I think that when we're stuck, you know, when we're stuck in a contradiction, it's very hard to know what to do, because you know there is this voice in our heads that says, you know, mom and dad want us to do this, or we should do this, you know. And let me just take a detour for just a moment. Maybe you've noticed this, you know. You can be hurrying through the day, hurrying, you know, and it just seems like there's not enough time for anything. You know, often my days are like that too. You know, I get into the office and I have so many things I have to do. And I'm trying to get them all done, and people are coming into the office and distracting me, and I have to help them, and it just seems so hard to get to the future, you know, that I want. And maybe at the end of the day I'll be very frazzled, you know. And then we'll come in here and sit, and it's so amazing, you know. It's like all day long there's not enough time for anything, and there's like this constant pressure. It's like pressure. It's like I've got to get to the next moment. And you know, that's really real. You know, that is, that's one aspect of time. You know, time is like this flow or this process of change. It's real. You know, it really is. On the other hand, you know, when you come in and you sit down on the cushion, you can enter this like almost timeless state. Everything is still and calm, and the moment is, sometimes it can seem like the moment is sort of eternal or timeless. And after meditating this morning, we went out and we walked through the grass, you know. And if you're going somewhere, if you have a destination and you're walking, you don't even notice where you put your feet because your eyes are sort of turned to the future. But today, it's possible that you're walking through the grass, and each step is like, you know, eternal. You know, it's like you take a step, and everything before you is just absolutely present. And then you take another step, and everything before you is just you're looking at the bees, and you hear the cicadas buzzing. And it's as though, you know, it's as though that moment had no time, you know. It was just like eternal. And we all have these moments, you know. Both of these, if you you know, from the Zen standpoint, both of these are real. It's not true that one is an illusion and one is not, you know. And it's interesting, you know, physicists say that time is really not happening. They say time is already over. Really, that's what they say. You know, Einstein's famous for saying time is an illusion. And then he made a little joke. He said, but it's an enduring illusion. But what he meant was, we think we're going through time, but really it's all over. And sometimes physicists represent time as a big loaf of bread, right? And, you know, there are these little slices, and we're moving from slice to slice, so we think we think it's in process. But they say really that universe is over. It's all done. And of course, we can't deal with that usually. Because usually we're moving from slice to slice, you know. And that's a real dimension of time, the motion, the flow. But there's this other dimension of time, right? When things become absolutely timeless. And from the Zen standpoint, that's not an illusion either. You know, the mind says time is either like this or time is like this. You know, but actually, time could have multiple aspects. If you investigate time, you'll notice it has multiple aspects. You know, there's this aspect which is always moving. And there's this aspect which is never moving. Right? And the little mind, which says it's either A or B, can't accept maybe that it's both. These are two dimensions of time. But they're both real. And we live, I think, like very unhappy lives sometimes, because we spend so much time in the first dimension of time, and not so much in the second dimension of time. But you know, one of the interesting things about life is that you know, we can quit graduate school and become a wine steward, if that's what our heart tells us to do. But you know, instantly there will be new contradictions. Every situation we're in is going to involve contradictions again, because you know, life isn't a road. It's not. That's something else. If you investigate on the cushion, things are not moving forward like a road, right? I don't think. You know, my father used to say, he used to lecture me after he'd had a few drinks, and he used to say I had to have a game plan. And his idea of a game plan was I should sit down at the age of 19 and say, when I'm 45, here's what I want to be. Now, I do think people should plan ahead, but there's something rather absurd about that, right? Because maybe you've had this experience, you know. You went to college and you thought you were going to major in pre-med. But then you took a course in psychology and you realized you didn't want to be a doctor, you wanted to be a psychologist. And then you took a course in art history and you realized you really wanted to be an art therapist. Yeah? Now, you know, if you think of life as like a straight line, this is a disaster, because you're being derouted. You're being, you know, you're being taken off, you're getting off the track, right? But maybe life isn't like that. You know, every time we're in a moment, it opens up like in multiple directions. It really does. There's always multiple directions. You know, if you think that your life is already laid out for you, like there's an angel in heaven who has a book, and it says, here's how it will begin and here's how it will end, then fine. But actually, I don't think there's such a book. Even for the universe, it's like every moment is very open. There's a kind of openness to the moment that scares us, right? Because we could get married or we could not get married. We could stay in graduate school or we can leave graduate school. And we think, oh, if only I knew how my story was going to turn out. But the story isn't over yet. And nobody knows, because actually, it's open. It's open. You know, physicists say that actually there might be multiple universes. And in multiple universes, you could say, I'm going to stay in graduate school, and one Larry Stone would stay in graduate school. But meanwhile, the other Larry Stone would become a wine sommelier. And there's two universes, one in which Larry Stone, they actually say this in all seriousness. It's based on, I guess, a quantum uncertainty. But there could be universes in which you took this decision and universes in which you took this decision. And that sounds crazy, but what they're getting at is that the universe is really open. See, actually, wherever you are, there's going to be like apparent contradictions, because you really can go in either way. And so, you know, it can drive you crazy after a while, especially if you think you're supposed to be somewhere else. Because when you get there, there's contradictions there too, right? So the thing is, this wonderful aspect of life, right? Which is the eternal moment, yeah? So you know, we're living in time, and we're going from moment to moment, and it keeps branching off, and it maybe drives us a little crazy. But it's possible. Sit down on the cushion and enter this other state where it's like absolutely timeless. And it's like the missing piece to the puzzle, right? I mean, if my friend Larry Stone had become a professor of comparative literature at Cal State, his life would have looked very different. Or maybe he would have dropped out of graduate school and become a technical writer for the Boeing company, as so many of my friends did. Or he could have become a wine sommelier, right? But you know, in any one of those lives, there would be this aspect of reality which is perfectly full and beautiful. You know, that beautiful fullness of the moment that's not going forward, it's just being there with us, you know, that's real. And it's always like 100%. It's always like 100%. So, wherever we are, we're going to have contradictions because the life is open. And it will never stop. And so if you're trying to resolve your contradictions, you're in for a rough ride. But the thing is, there's this other dimension to life, this other dimension to time, which is this eternal moment. And it's like no matter what choice you make, you're going to have that in your life. And so I think it's very important to spend some time in that state. You know? Probably our culture overemphasizes the first state. You know, the flowing time. We're like insane about it, right? We don't spend enough time. You know, if you ever go to like a Chinese garden or a Japanese garden, you know, it's supposed to slow you down, right? It's supposed to, you're supposed to stop and stay in the moment and look down at the bees in the clover at your feet, you know. And then you suddenly realize, my God, this is timeless. This is beautiful. So different cultures have like different emphasis, right? And ours is like insanely forward-looking. But anyway, you don't have to be insane. Right? You don't have to live that way. You came here today to explore reality in the non-dual mind, and one of the things you might have discovered was this beautiful, beautiful fullness to the moment. You know? You might not have come, if you came at 7 o'clock, you might not have made that discovery in the fifth sit, when you're thinking, when is he going to ring the bell? Right? You know, at that moment, every second seems to drag on like an eternity. Right? Time can't go fast enough, right? But then, you know, you take a little break, you go to the bathroom, you have a sip of water, and we step outside, and suddenly it's like the eternal moment. So beautiful, right? So life never turns out the way we planned. It never turns out the way we planned, because it's really like open. And yet, you know, that doesn't have to cause us distress. You know, because every time we wind up in that moment, we realize this is absolutely perfect. You know, so in a universe where my friend Larry went to sommelier school, you know, there's a dimension of his life that is absolutely perfect. And if he went to Cal State or someplace like that and he's teaching comp lit, there's a dimension of his life that's absolutely perfect. And so on. And there's a dimension of our lives that's like that too, if we choose to make time for that dimension. So that's what you did today, and I hope you had a little taste of that, that beautiful moment. Gosho said to his monks, Seijo's soul separated from her being. Which is the real Seijo? Mumon's comment. When you realize what the real is, you will see that we pass from one husk to another, like travelers. This is like we're going, right? One minute, if you know, 20 years ago, I had black hair, you know. Then I had, you know, salt and pepper hair. Now I have gray hair, you know. Like, forms are changing all the time. You know, but that's not all there is to the story. Right? Mumon doesn't tell us that because this is a koan. He wants us to find out. He says, if you don't know there's something more, you're going to be like a crab in the boiling water thrashing around. There's a wonderful line in the Tao Te Ching. I believe it's in the Tao Te Ching. It's been translated like this. It's like, if you don't know the secret of change, you're going to be torn apart on the lathe of heaven. That's one way to translate it. You know, a lathe is like, you put a long piece of wood in a lathe, you turn it on and it spins the wood, and you take a blade and you cut a design in the wood. And this is what the universe is doing to us all the time. Right? So you have to know how to be flexible. Right? And Lao Tzu says, if you can't be flexible, you're going to be like torn apart by change. But how do you be flexible? You know, you need to know the secret. The secret is this eternal moment. So if you don't know it, you're going to be like a crab in boiling water. Look out, he says. The moon above the clouds is ever the same. See, that's that eternal moment. Valleys and mountains are separate from each other. That's our life and time. All are blessed. All are blessed. Are they one or are they two?